All right. Always interesting to come into a room for the first time and try to figure out where to begin or what to say, so I always find it's best to start at the beginning. So I want to talk about three ideas today and how they intertwine or how they can be integrated. And the first one is awakening or waking up, or Buddha. What did the Buddha do? So a little bit about awakening through the practice of mindfulness, talking about mindfulness. And then I want to talk about Dharma, this word Dharma that probably many of you know, the Dharma, as kind of a three systems that work well together. So we could ask the million-dollar question, what did the Buddha do? Well, he woke up. How did he do it? He practiced and cultivated and really invented this practice of mindfulness. And so what did he do? He woke up. How did he do it through mindfulness? And what did he wake up to? What is the experience of the awakened mind? What is that like? And that is the Dharma. He woke up to the Dharma, this word that's kind of hard to translate, but really means, we could say he woke up to the reality of reality. He woke up to a perspective about life and a way of seeing things in a way that were very clear and very accurate and also very compassionate. And basically, he woke up to this, what I would say is a little bit of a paradox that I think we've all seen many times, and this perspective that really life is both and, right? Life is beautiful and life is tragic. And I think if we just sort of self-diagnose our experience thus far in life, we can conjure up memories pretty quick of both of those being the case. There's a lot of beautiful things in this world. There's a lot of connection. There's a lot of really things to be appreciative towards. And there's also a lot of difficulty. There's a lot of loss and confusion and frustration. And life is not so easy some of the time. You might have noticed that. Life can be quite hard. And so it's not one way or the other. It's actually both of these things are true at the same time. And how can we learn how to move through that reality in a way where we don't suffer about that? And so really, I think what he woke up to in a very simple way is he woke up to the reality in his own experience, and he also saw it in other people. He woke up to the reality that people tend to suffer in ways that seem quite unnecessary. And that there's this way in which human beings suffer about a wide range of topics in ways and systems that seem sort of unnecessary and problematic in that way. And we suffer about things that don't even happen. Or we worry about things that haven't happened yet and may never happen. Because we can reflect on the past and we can use our memories and say, well, bad things have happened in my life before, so then I could assume some bad things are going to probably happen again later. Just like some great things have happened before. So we can kind of get into this idea where we feel like we might be clairvoyant or something. And then what happens is we suffer. And we suffer in these interesting ways because we find oftentimes that we don't like how things are. Have you ever been in a moment recently where you thought this moment should be different? Have you ever had the thought, oh my God, this should not be happening right now? This shouldn't be happening right now. You shouldn't be doing that right now. They shouldn't be doing this right now. Nobody should be doing that right now. And it gets us into this way where we cut off from the experience that we're having. And a lot of times in our lives, we get caught in this kind of feedback loop that I find where there's the life that I'm actually having, which is all of us sitting in this room right now. And then in my mind, there is actually this little sense of how things could be different. And how things could be different. And if they were only different, then I would be happy. Or then my life would have meaning and purpose. If only things were different, then that would mean something else about my life. But things aren't different. They're like this. This isn't so good. Aggravated and disappointed. And then the narrative, the story comes in. I'm this person who has this difficult time and aggravated and disappointed by life. And people don't do what they say. And it's all happening to me, and why do these things happen to me, and it doesn't seem fair, and everybody else seems to be doing much better, and how come? And, you know, the self, the Buddha talks about this problematic nature of the self, and it's a troublemaker. I don't know about you, but my favorite topic, if I was to make a list of the five things I suffer about the most in life, I'm right at the top. I give myself privilege. Me, mine, my life, my problems, my difficulties. And so, you know, he woke up to this reality. He said, well, this is happening for everybody. This is how it is. It's happening for me. It's happening for everybody else. And, you know, I think his big question or his big existential crisis was, I wonder if there's something you can do about that. Are we just, like, stuck with these kind of not great contraptions of the mind and we just kind of do our best to make do with our memories and our plans and just kind of, you know, do the best we can with this mind and this life that we have? Or is there something that can be done about that? And I think this was his great quest. And when we look at the life of the Buddha, which I'm very, very interested in, we probably all know the story that if you saw the PBS documentary, that this prince who grew up in this big fancy palace and had all these things given to him and had everything he ever needed and wanted, and his family protected him from the outside world. Great story, great documentary, but definitely not the truth. Because there were no palaces in that time in the world. There were no palaces in ancient India. There was no way that that's what happened, even though it's a wonderful story. And I actually find it's more useful to me to see the Buddha as a human being who really probably wasn't much different than any of us sitting in this room. And so he would have grown up in an agricultural time, an agricultural community. He probably was like a really, really rich farmer's kid and probably was more privileged than the other people in his community. And his conditioning would have been really dictated by the sun. In fact, his tribe was called the Sakyans, which means sun worshippers. So his family, his community, which had been more of a tribal community, more so than a rich palace family, they would have worshipped the sun because they probably knew very clearly that was the sun and water that provided them agriculture. And that was the kind of abundance and culture and economy of the day was agriculture. And so he would have been very aware, and his conditioning would have been driven by the idea of a seed and a fruit. Right? We know this analogy very well, that the world and the external world is dictated in abundance by sustenance of there being a seed. And if that seed is planted in the proper soil and given the proper conditions of sunlight and water, that seed will, that the little, looks like a little rock, will eventually be a delicious mango, mm-hmm. or in Paonia, peaches. And so he also thought, well, if that's true in the external world, I wonder if that's true internally. So can I take an idea like gratitude, and can I grow that internally? Can I take an idea like compassion, or kindness, or generosity, or wisdom, or mindfulness? Because all of these ideas, all of these seeds came on your hard drive. You were born with these, probably more like software than hardware, unfortunately. But he saw that there's a way in which you can do that, that can be cultivated. Of course, we ended up with this term meditation, which is not really the term they used back then. They used this word bhavana, which means to cultivate, which is really actually an agricultural term, isn't it? And, you know, he would have been conditioned by the idea of the sun. And the sun, I think, represents two very important ideas, which the two very important ideas that guided the Buddha's teaching for 45 years. And the first one is of light, that the sun provides light or awareness or wisdom or illumination. That what we do in mindfulness practice and meditation practice is we take things that were unknown, we take things out of the darkness and we bring them into the light so that we can see clearly. We can see through the light of wisdom, understanding, seeing clearly. Needs light. We need to have that vision. So mindfulness is a way of seeing things as they are, or seeing things as they happen, right? And also the sun represents warmth, right? Which is compassion, which is a sense of caring, a sense of conscious, a sense of concern, a sense of bringing that also to it. So it's about seeing clearly, waking up to the reality of reality, what we can expect really in an accurate, pragmatic way about this human condition, and also to seeing the pain of the world, as the Buddha often says, seeing the pain of the world, that we can't help but be inclined towards compassion. We're wired for connection, as the neuroscientists say, and the attachment theory people say, that the human beings are actually, we're wired to connect with each other. We're not really wired to compete with each other and to hurt each other and to blame each other, although we do seem to do plenty of that. But we're actually biologically wired to connect. And so if I understand my experience and I understand my struggle, and I understand that, you know, everybody's having their own unique little hard time, that gives me the prompting of compassion or of seeing the pain of the world. I wanna not only wanna help myself, but I wanna help others. And this is sort of what prompted the Buddha into seeing things through these classic lenses of wisdom and compassion, wisdom and compassion, wisdom and compassion. We hear that so much. But again, those are fairly ambiguous terms. What is wisdom? Right? So I really think it's been important for me to understand what were the conditions that allowed this individual, the Buddha, to wake up and to see things in this way. And when I think of him as a human and the humanity of what he went up against, it makes me feel more willing and more interested and really more inspired and encouraged to do the same. So he woke up. He woke up to this kind of way of seeing things, this kind of mode of operating. He didn't wake up. And we get stuck with these kind of terms like enlightenment. And as Buddhism, or the Dharma, I should say, spread from continent to continent, we ended up with sort of like this idea of enlightenment and the Buddha understanding the unconditioned or the absolute truth, or that he knew something, he broke through to some ultimate truth of reality, which kind of just, to me, starts to sound like Buddhist heaven. You know, the idea that not even an unwholesome thought would ever arise in the mind of the liberated Buddha. But I don't think that's true. I think the Buddha probably didn't like pain. I think he probably was annoyed by some of the stuff that went on in his communities, as he talks about throughout the canon. You always get a sense of the Buddha kind of being a little bit frustrated at times. You know, there's so many stories in the Pali Canon where the Buddha goes somewhere and somebody does something and he's like, man, you guys. And there's stories of him like going to the monastery and they're arguing and he like leaves. He's like, I'm out of here. And then he goes and like talks to an elephant, which he probably didn't do. But there's all these really great stories where you get this, you get a sense of this person being very human and getting frustrated and having to deal with conflict and having to deal with the pain of his body and his back that was in pain as he got older. I notice my back's getting a little sore these days. I'm like, oh, the Buddha had a sore back too. It's like, okay. It really helps, I think, to see him in a human way. And when he think about waking up, this is sort of what he did, is he woke up to this reality of pleasure and pain and gain and loss and tragedy and beauty, and really this kind of, I think, almost paradoxical view that life is very complex. And how he did that was through mindfulness. Mindfulness is really the oldest form of Buddhist meditation. The Satipatthana Sutta, which was the way the Buddha articulated the practices of mindfulness by taking human experience and narrowing it into four particular fields. There's the field of the body, right? It's very pragmatic. We have the body field in five senses, present time awareness of the body. We have the feeling field, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. Every sense object has a charge. It's either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, or neither, we should say. And in the next field, we have the mind field, which is the, I love that, mind field. I love saying that. Because I feel like my mind is like a mind field sometimes. I'm like, what is going on with this thing? And in the mind, in this, we have emotions, and we have mind states, and we have attitudes, and we have grasping, and we have resisting. We want things to be a certain way. We want things to not be a certain way. And if you watch your mind, if I watch my mind, mostly what it does is it's just trying to pull in the stuff that I want and get rid of the stuff I don't want. And I can just sit back and go, yep, that's just what it does. Gotta do this, you gotta do that. Every week, I gotta do this, 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 and I gotta get rid of this, 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 and this. And if I could just get that all sorted out, that'd be so good for me. Oh, it'd be so good if everybody would just do what they're supposed to do. Right? And then that can go on for years, right? And so that's kind of how he woke up to that. And he said, okay, well, you can watch experience. You can actually watch your mind with the mind. And this is one of the areas that I think is so beautiful now with science and this practice of mindfulness has really, really kind of come together. And that what we really have, me and Shannon were listening to this podcast with Dan Goleman and Richard Davidson, who have been doing all this research. And this basic idea that, like, we were born with this wealth of real estate in our prefrontal cortex, which is what allows us to remember and to see, which allows us to past and future and calculate that. But how much trouble do you get yourself into about past and future? Oh my God. So it's like, you know, so it's like the area in this idea of neuroplasticity, and Richard Davidson, the scientist, says, he goes, neuroplasticity isn't necessarily good. It can cause a lot of problems. So it's the way in which we train the mind that's going to have the outcome for us. And so in mindfulness practice, what the Buddha is saying very clearly is that we can really start to learn and to watch that what we think about has results. Our views have results. How do we view the world? How do we view ourselves? How do we view others? How do we perceive? How are we perceiving and interpreting anything in any particular moment? And to question that and to be aware of that. Does this perspective, does this view, opinion lead to happiness and well-being, or does it lead to suffering? Do you have any opinions and views about things that you suffer about? Maybe you want to question some of those. And then this intention, what do we do about that? Through speech and through action and through a way of living. And so he woke up through mindfulness. It was through mindfulness, sitting this experience of him sitting under this tree that we've probably all heard much about. Of course, we don't know what he did under that tree or even if he sat under a tree. But he did. He woke up. And he woke up to this way in which he saw how things happened. And sometimes this word dharma is translated as to see things as they are. But actually, more accurately, it's to see things as they happen. Because things aren't a certain way, right? Life isn't sort of this fixed thing. Life is this whole complex matrix of change and difficulty and self and other. So see how those things happen. And for that, again, the very basic question, how do I create suffering for myself in my own experience? You know? How does that happen? Can I intervene on that process? Can I watch how that happens? And can I make all these little adjustments? And I think that's what we do in mindfulness practice, whether we recognize it or not, is we're making all these like cognitive, emotional adjustments. You know, we're thinking about something that we're worried about, we've been worried about for the last 3 days. We just, no, we bring our attention back. No, I'm not going to do that right now. I'm going to let that go. Right? Let that be. We train ourselves to kind of see, and really this cause and effect, or what's called karma, which is a very, very troubling word. Karma, everybody uses it incorrectly. But this karma, this cause and effect, okay, when I think about that, what's the result? When I have a fear about the future, and I let my attention go into that fear, I start to worry, I start to anticipate. I mean, if I go really far, I start to expect that it will happen, and now I got to solve that problem and fix it. And I was like, wait a minute, man, what's going on? I'm just sitting in this like beautiful church right now on a Tuesday afternoon. None of that is even happening right now. Right? So we can see, we can almost follow this little trail of psychological breadcrumbs and see, okay, let that one go. Let that be. And just sort of come back. And so when he spent 45 years talking about this, and I think that one of the things that I've learned in my therapeutic work more than my Dharma practice is one thing about mindfulness that I've grown to really appreciate and also have continued to be frustrated by is what mindfulness really has done for me in a very pragmatic way is it's giving me the ability to navigate complexity. Whether it's my emotional complexity, my relational complexity, my financial complexity, political complexity, like life is really, really complex. There's a lot of things going on. Anybody have a lot of things going on right now? Anybody have too many things going on right now? Right. So mindfulness allows us to kind of move through that terrain, through that psycho-emotional relational terrain with some skill and some ability, but because it's so complex, it carries with it a degree of stress. It carries with it like a type of angst or a type of challenge or even a type of adversity. You know, and really in the Buddha's First Noble Truth, one of the things he always talks about, some of you might know this term dukkha, which is sort of poorly translated as suffering, but really best translated as sort of difficulty or dissatisfaction, or really I would say adversity. And he just, right out of the gate, he's like, yeah, man, like, you're going to have some. Life is going to be a bumpy ride. You know, it's just going to be. And so what we really want to be able to develop in this mindfulness practice, if we know life is going to be a bumpy ride, we have to stop thinking and trying to develop a strategy to just avoid, like, how do I avoid that? That's what I want to know. I would love to sit here and give you that lecture, but I would be totally lying to you. Here's how you avoid difficulty. Here's how you have an easy life and don't have any problems with anybody in the world. It's like, yeah, that's the kind of classic tale. But really, this resiliency we want to develop, and we want to be able to overcome challenges, whether they're psychological challenges, emotional challenges, relational challenges. We want to be able to overcome and to recover from those experiences more quickly than we have in the past. So to some degree, when we're really trying to bring mindfulness in a way that's going to have the results that we want, is I think we're kind of, whether we realize it or not, we're kind of signing up for some adversity, right? Because if we're going to use this analogy of light or awareness, you know what one of the byproducts of awareness is? Awareness. And all of a sudden you start to become aware of a whole bunch of stuff you didn't even know about yourself. You're like, oh my God, I knew my mind was bad, but I didn't think it was like this bad. And then it's like, well, I want to switch the mindfulness off now. You know, shut it down. I don't actually want to know. I want to, ignorance is bliss, right? And so we come into that. So part of, I think, the practice is to some degree is we're always working with some kind of an edge. And I find this to be true. And I find myself being aggravated and disappointed by this more often than I would like to admit. But there's always some kind of edge in my practice. There's always some kind of edge in my life. Mm-hmm. But when we see an edge, the nature of an edge is when we first come into contact with an edge, it's kind of sharp, right? Kind of, ooh, ouch. But the more we recognize that edge and we kind of start to lean into it, we're like, oh. And we kind of wear that down and it becomes not so much an edge, it becomes more round. And kind of, and what used to be a really, really hard experience for me, not so bad. And then I work with that and I'm able to deal with that. And then you know what comes next? The next edge. So that's kind of, I think, one of the things we have to expect when we start to use mindfulness in a way that's more of a liberation-based kind of way of operating, is that we want to expect and to some degree encourage the more learning. That there are more things about myself I want to understand, and that there's, I have yet to run out of edges. I don't anticipate that happening anytime soon. But part of it is the knowing of that sometimes calms me down a little bit. I'm like, okay, cool. I got some new material to work with. Whether it's relational, financial, emotional, psychological. Again, these edges come in a complex delivery system. So I do want to save some time for some questions or comments, but I just kind of wanted to, being the first time in the room, I like to start at the beginning of trying to, I see the practice in a way that's very pragmatic, but also in a way that feels very doable. So like we could like leave the room and start. I'm sure many of you are already practicing, but really feeling like, okay, I'm up for the challenge of this, and that we don't create what I've been accused of in the past, and many practitioners, of a spiritual bypass, where we start to use these practices as a way to avoid things. Which is really easy to do, and we're probably all doing a little bit of that anyway. That's okay. But I think we really want to kind of be careful that we don't start thinking that this is some sort of way to bypass or to avoid or to get rid of experiences that are hard or challenging. It's actually quite the opposite.
Yeah,
So I'm going to stop this.